session number 18336, Reel 1.
Jim Wills, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
Gillingham in Dorset.
Which year was this? Which year?
Oh, 1917.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Gillingham?
No. I grew up at the village of Ilchester in Somerset, which is 2 miles from the Yeovilton naval camp, the Fleet Air Arm.
How old were you when you left school?
14.
Did you get a job?
I went to a job, yes, but I had 2 or 3 jobs by the time I was 18, so I said to my mother, I'm going to join the services.
What job had your father done?
Pardon?
What job had your father done?
My father was a landlord of a public house, and I didn't see much of him because he was at work. He was working when we were not, when we were at home. But, he was a landlord for many, many, well, 30-odd years.
Why did you decide to join the services?
Because I found that in the locality, local factories and etc., unless your father and uncle and brothers worked there, you didn't stand a chance of getting anywhere. So I thought, well, I'll join the services to see a bit of the world. And I was always keen on the Air Force.
Why didn't you try for the Fleet Air Arm if that was in the air?
I had the opportunity to later on, but I turned it down, and I'm glad I did, because I hated being in confined spaces. And before the war broke out, I was actually working with the fleet at Air Arm, we were training their pilots at Netherhaven. And they came around then, and they offered everybody one step forward in promotion to remuster from the Air Force to the Fleet Air Arm. Because at the time, the Air Force were running the Fleet Air Arm, personal.
Did many people take up the offer?
Very few that I know of. One or two from our crowd did, but I don't think many of them lasted very long, to be sure. I mean, we were losing carriers very quickly in those days.
Is that why people didn't want to transfer?
I think so, for one reason. And also, if you set your mind on the Air Force, I was very keen on the Air Force.
Now, coming back to joining up, how did you go about it?
I wrote away as normally the Kingsway House. There was an advert in the paper, and I had to go to Dorchester for my preliminary medical examination. And after I'd come through Dorchester, well, I had to wait then until they sent for me to report to Kingsway House in London.
What were they looking for as far as your health was concerned?
Well, everything, really, yeah. In those days, you had to have so many teeth, full set of teeth, no hair, no glasses, no hearing aids, and you were a fit A1. You were taken in as A1 medically.
What was the next step for you?
The next step was the education test, I think, came first before the medical, but anyways, all in the same day. And the next step, you were told whether you accepted or turned down. And we were sent off then to West Drayton as a holding unit for about 3 days, I think.
What happened to you at West Drayton?
Well, this is where you were issued with your service number. They were given to you on a small piece of paper, and please remember this. Well, I mean, you remember that to the end of your days. And you had the king, you were sworn in, and you had the king's shilling, which I remember we had to sign for.
It was an actual shilling, was it?
Oh, yeah.
What do you remember next?
Well, the next was being at West Drayton. From West Drayton then, they started issuing uniforms. Nine times out of ten, you had one that was too big, or somebody else had the one that was too small. But anyway, you sorted it out. And of course, then you had to sew you that service number on every article of clothing you received. Shirts, vests, long johns in those days, and even your tunics. You always had to have your number, so that when you did a kit inspection, everything was laid out with the number showing in the front. I had a, that's a kit inspection at Oxbridge.
What were the kit inspections like?
Oh, they were murder. And they had to be just so, you know, everything had to be in its place. And if the orderly sergeant didn't like you, he'd make a mess of it for you. And then the time the orderly officer came around, you were in the flat.
Why should he not like you?
Oh, they had their good boys, good boys and bad boys. You know, no, they had a way of taking the mickey. And they were only corporals, you know. We used to think they were little tin gods. What the corporal said, yes.
Were you a good boy or a bad boy?
I was a good one. I can even remember the end of my training. You had to do guard duties. And I was so smart, I was picked out as a stick man, what they call a stick man, which you didn't go on actual guard sentry duty. You stayed in the guardhouse, ready to take messages and go to different places. And I was quite thrilled with that, and so was the corporal, because he brought... Anyway... Cut a long story short. Later on in service life, I finished in Manston as a corporal, and I was guard commander there one night, and who should be the orderly officer but my ex-corporal instructor, who was at Uxbridge at the time I was a recruit, and he remembered me, and he made sure I did everything just so. Warrant Officer Reffel. He'd gone from corporal to warrant officer in a very short time.
So you went from West Drayton to Uxbridge?
Uxbridge, that's right. Now, Uxbridge is like, the only way I'd liken it to anywhere else is the Limpston camp out here. They either made you or broke you. And you even, the discipline was such, you, every pay parade, every man had to buy a hair cutting disc for sixpence. It was a little plastic disc which you had to show on your kit inspection, but you had to carry it with you when on the parade ground, because the barber shop was up the top of the corner, top of the square. And if they had nothing to do, the barbers would come and lean outside. And a corporal or sergeant, he'd pick out anybody. You, haircut, haircut. Whether you have one yesterday, you still had to have it. Get rid of that disc. Oh, it was...
Was the disc a token?
It was a token, yeah. But you had to have one. You had to, it cost sixpence out of your wages. You had to have one on show for kit inspection and also carry it with you when there wasn't kit inspection. Because they'd stop you anywhere, haircut. And you had to come back, report to the corp, you would have one.
And that cost you sixpence?
Yeah. And that was a lot of money in those days. But these barbers, you see, they had a way. They just be outside watching everybody drilling. But and if you're, one minute you'd be in PT, doing PT on the square, all loose gravel, square, hands and knees, next minute you'd be square bashing. But to be quite honest, I enjoyed it at Uxbridge. You know, although it was hard. And then, like when you became the finals on your final week of pass, when you were senior squad, as it was, we used to march out to church parade in Uxbridge, behind the central band, and that was the end of your training. Once you'd done that, and that really gave you a very nice note to finish on, really.
Was there any mistreatment of the recruits at Uxbridge?
Occasionally, if somebody didn't like to wash, the rest of the squad would make sure he'd had a wash, you know. They'd even strip him off and throw him in a cold bath, come to that. They looked after one another. It was a case of he's letting the squad down. So we'd do something about it.
But was there any mistreatment by the NCOs?
Not that I know of. I've never... They bully you, they call you all the names under the sun, you know. But that's all part of the build-up, I think. It was.
Where did you go to after Uxbridge?
After Uxbridge, my first posting was to Oserum. As was Salisbury Plain, just outside Salisbury, actually. And I was quite happy there.
What were you supposed to be doing there?
I was general duties, ACH, aircraft and general duties, second class. That was the lowest of the low. And then after a very short while, I applied for... technical training, because I wanted to be amongst the aircraft. Anyway, I got my training and was sent to Manston.
To be trained at Manston
as a fitter's mate. It was basically, you were trained as fitter's mate. Now, training, at the end, if you pass the exam, if you pass with the 60% or over, you went on to further training, either as a flight rigger or flight mechanic, whichever they considered you were most suitable for. I was selected and went as a flight rigger. Now, to do that training, I went to Henlo for 9 months, Henlo in Bedfordshire, and I got posted back to Netherhaven, and although we were miles right out in the Salisbury Plain, quite a happy station, and it was number one flying training school, and they'd recently moved down from one of the stations in Scotland, either Wick or Montrose. Anyway, I'm nearly all English personnel, but we still had the Scotch band, pipes and drums. And we had a good mile to march from our living accommodation to working. So they used to march us to and from the work. And it was coming. We had to work one Sunday, and that was the first Sunday we'd ever been asked to work Sunday mornings. And we were halfway back towards lunch, and the tannoy system went to say that we were at war.
How did you feel about it?
Well, I don't know. I can't remember, but I don't think anybody felt afraid or anything like that. We felt, well, that's what we've been training for. I mean, I'd done 3 years then, you see. 3 years training.
Had you expected a war to break out?
No, not really. Because we'd had appeasements before, you know. Chamber had come back with his messages. We are safe, such and such. But it did broke out, and things went along all right for a week or two, but after a while, things started to speed up, and they wanted more skilled tradesmen, fitters, which is equivalent to what the boys' service do 5 years apprenticeship for. Anyway, I was recommended to go on that course from conversion from flight rigger to fitter to airframe. And we went to Hednesford to start with the course. And the moment we got there, it's just outside Walsall. There was a railway halt. For the camp, and you're on a hill like that. We used to call it climbing Kitbag Hill. Once you walked up there with your full kit. Anyway, no sooner we got there, it started snowing. And we didn't see outside the camp for about 3 days.
This is a photograph you're showing me.
Pardon?
This is a photograph of RAF Hednesford.
Yeah, and the snow building up.
This was the winter of 39-40, I think.
39-40, yeah.
Had you thought it right that we should declare war on Germany?
Well, I didn't see why not, because they were the aggressors, yeah. It didn't worry me, you know. We were at war, and we still had our jobs to do, which we were carrying out more or less as usual.
What did your work involve as a fitter?
Fitter airframes. I could work on any part of the aircraft. Well, I did work on any part of the aircraft except the engine.
What typically would you have to do?
Well, I mean, skin repairs and changing, testing for levels of dihedral and things like that on the planes, and generally keeping them in good order. The hydraulic system was always come under me. Where were we then? Hednesford. We got halfway through the course at Hednesford, and we got transferred to Cosford. The boys got moved back to Halton, and we went to Cosford, and the very hangar where they do all the gymnasts, the 3A's, you know, indoor championships and things like that. I helped scrub that floor with petrol and white lead because this was Whitsun, the first year of the war, and we normally had a Whitsun break, but seeing it was wartime, we didn't get any time off at all. And we had to clean the hangar from top to bottom because His Majesty the King and Queen Elizabeth were coming around. And there was bull, you never seen bull like it. Anyway, everything went swimmingly and lovely. And we were all sat in our classes, maybe about 20, 30 in a class with the instructor. And the King and the Queen came walking down through the main aisle. And with the same, the nappy van pulled up outside with the tea and wads. And everybody just made one mad dash. The poor old King and the Queen, unless you saw it, you would never believe it. They were running all ways to avoid them. It was, we thought it was good fun, but eventually we were all put on parade, and told that we were all confined to camp for a week for bad manners, which nobody cared much about anyway. But there we are. I'll never forget that. She was beautiful then. She still is now. One of my favourites.
Why did they all do that? Because of the char and the wads?
Well, it was normal procedure. Whoever got there first got served first, you see. And you always had your mug with you, and your tea and wad. Like the equivalent Women's Royal Voluntary Service, you see, and the nappy. They had nappy, proper nappy vans, I suppose you've seen them.
Why was it so important to get the char and wads?
Well, because it was your break time. I mean, they did things they didn't confer us. Oh, and the point was that when the Majesty left the camp, we had line up towards the main gate. And the officer said, three cheers for His Majesty, hip hip, not a sound. Only the officers would cheer. So the Yorks had already been told they'd lost a week. yeah. But that we consider that fun. we were fighting against discipline, really. Fighting against discipline.
Was discipline in the RAF strict?
It could be. It could be very strict. It all depends on the circumstance. If you were if you're ordered to do something, you're always told to obey the last order, whether you agree with it or not. Anyway, after I left Colesford, I went to Little Risington in Gloucester. There's another flying training school in the Cotswolds. And I hadn't been there about a month, 6 weeks, something like that. So I was put on embarkation.
Which year is this now?
This is still 1940.
Did the Battle of Britain make much of an impact on you?
No, I didn't see much of that, to be quite honest, because I was, as I say, I was on embarkation, and I was on embarkation leave for 3 weeks, and then went back to camp, because they couldn't give any fixed date then because of the secrecy on the ship sailing. And anyway, the outcome of it was they sent me back home again for another week, and I said to my girlfriend, my wife, we were engaged at the time, well, let's get married. This was on a Sunday. We were married on the Thursday, and I was back in camp again on the Sunday. And this time we all went up to London, the School of Tropical Diseases, for injections about different things, which we understood that once we had those, we were going somewhere where the climate wasn't very good. And then we got issued with our khaki drill, and eventually finished up in Scotland, in Gorock, on the Clyde.
So during the Battle of Britain, you weren't repairing aircraft, which
you
didn't
have? No, not during the Battle of Britain, no. Well, the odd one or two that were at Little Risington.
But the fact that there was a war on didn't change your opinion about getting engaged or married?
Oh, no. No, we said, well, seeing I don't know how long I'll be away, might be a year, 2 years, might be 4 years. Because 4 or 5 years in those days was a normal posting abroad.
Was your wife in the forces?
No. No, she wasn't. And, well, that was one reason why we got married, I think, because she had a job which she could carry on with, and working for Clark's to shoot people. And anyway, we eventually set sail from Gorock on the Warwick Castle, which was a lovely boat.